From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Speaking to other people, especially when you're talking about potentials of war and death and famine and lots of other things, you meet.
That was President Donald Trump Monday, after being asked by a reporter if he would be willing to meet with Iran's President Hassan Rouhani.
There's nothing wrong with meeting. We met, as you know, with Chairman Kim, and you haven't had a missile fired off in 9 months. We got our prisoners back. So many things have happened, so positive. But meeting with people, I had a great meeting, in my opinion. Of course, the fake news didn't cover it that way, but I had a great meeting with President Putin of Russia. I think it was a great meeting in terms of the future, in terms of safety and economic development and protecting Israel and protecting everybody. I thought it was a great meeting. Great meeting with NATO. I just explained NATO. Hundreds of billions of dollars more money will be paid into NATO, the coffers of NATO, and much already has. So I believe in meeting. I would certainly meet with Iran if they wanted to meet. I don't know that they're ready yet. They're having a hard time right now. But I ended the Iran deal. It was a ridiculous deal. I do believe that they will probably end up wanting to meet, and I'm ready to meet anytime they want to. And I don't do that from strength or from weakness. I think it's an appropriate thing to do. If we could work something out that's meaningful, not the waste of paper that the other deal was, I would certainly be willing to meet.
Do you have preconditions for that meeting?
No preconditions, no. They want to meet, I'll meet anytime they want.
Today we discussed the idea of President Trump as a peace president with Professor Tony Montero. We caught up with him live in Philadelphia and spoke with him via Skype Thursday. Professor Montero, it's a pleasure to have you with us. Let's start with this article you pointed me to in the Financial Times.
Okay. Let me first of all say that for people who are really interested in dissecting and understanding this moment in history, I would encourage them to read the Financial Times. One of the conclusions that I drew from the article, although the author doesn't say it, is that Trump, in essence, rejects the concept of the unipolar world.
Yep.
Dominated by the United States. And what the author then says is that in the end, China benefits from Trump's policies of economic and military pullback from the idea of a unipolar world or a single hegemon, which is another way of saying, Don, what we have been trying to say over these many months, that by rejecting the unipolar world, Donald Trump, ironically, is pursuing a path of non-aggression. I refer to him as the most pro-peace president since Kennedy.
Yep.
And it's all over the better analyses that we find, for example, in the Financial Times, such an essay, such an opinion piece, you would never find, never in the New York Times or the Washington Post or the LA Times or on CNN or anywhere else in the corporate media of this country. So it's very fascinating what they're seeing. And what the author also sees is that China has assumed that the 21st century will not be the century like the 20th, will not be the century of the Atlantic, but it will be the century of the Pacific,
right,
which is another way of saying it is the century of Asia.
Right.
Asia will be the pivot of economic development, and I would add technological development.
Right. You know, There's an interesting thing at work here when you talk about the Financial Times, and this was also true, still to a degree, but before Murdoch particularly bought the Wall Street Journal, of the Wall Street Journal. And that is not the part that's out there for the rubes, for public discussion, but when you see analysis by the bourgeoisie of things, their analysis is probably among the most rigorous Marxist analysis of events all. Because, as it turns out, Marx is right. They know it. And they're saying, okay, well, so what, despite what we think is going on, what's actually going on, so we can figure out how to stay here in the, you know, in the big chair or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so you see this article that you referenced in Financial Times says, one for all his let's be nice mood, etc., Trump is progressively dismantling the pillars of the U.S.-led international order. Mm-hmm. One way or another, the president has undermined the U.S. commitments to climate change, nuclear nonproliferation, NATO, the EU, longstanding relationships with Japan and South Korea. No one can tell that he won't tear up tomorrow NAFTA or pull U.S. troops out of the Middle East. Says right. The credibility and trust on which U.S. power was built is draining away. Now, I don't know about that, because that assumes a bunch of willing players that are equals, and I see it more, an empire from top down. What it does do is show the people who've been following instructions that maybe there's some room for them to jump off of the strings. And then there's things like we saw, and I mentioned this when the campaign was going on with NATO, when he was making a demand that the other countries pony up 2% of their GDP, I saw that as undermining NATO.
No question.
Because the reality of it is that if you go into all of these European countries that have austerity budgets in place for the last 10 years and say we now have to give the United States another 1% of our GDP for NATO, they'll be in the street saying, bye-bye, NATO.
Right. That's right. That's right.
And that's the dynamic here in general.
That's right. And you know, first of all, we have to acknowledge that in the United States, we live under the most brutal form of the dictatorship of financial capital, the most the greatest authoritarian control of thought and sources of information, from social media up to the New York Times and the rest of them.
Yep.
I mean, this is the most brutal form of the dictatorship of finance capital of any country in the world, of any regime perhaps in history.
Yep.
Let's acknowledge that.
For sure.
Now, Trump was elected as a rogue, as an outsider.
That's right.
As a candidate, a politician challenging the form of the dictatorship of finance capital,
yep,
both domestically and in international relationships.
Yep.
And he knows what the Europeans have known for decades. You cannot afford what we call the welfare state in a time of shrinking economic power and domination of Europe and America. You cannot afford the welfare state and the warfare state at the same time.
That's right.
And when Trump says that he will turn, as he said in 2016, he will turn the Republican Party into a workers' party, that didn't mean necessarily a socialist party,
right,
but a party sensitive and so on, to the interests of working people broadly conceived.
Right.
Now, that is a statement of aspiration. It is not a statement of how you do that. There's right. a lot to debate around that. But the fact of the matter is, if you look at what he is doing in foreign policy, the actual retreat from, or setting up a retreat from, NATO, this is huge,
yep,
because NATO is the spearhead of Euro-American aggression in most of the world, including Afghanistan, yep. including Libya, including Syria, including the Ukraine, including the Baltic states. I mean, come on.
Yep. And it's going to be the entity that engages in World War III with Russia, should that come to pass.
Absolutely.
And that's actually its organizing principle.
Absolutely.
You know, and
NATO is but a cover for U.S. militarism.
Right, yep.
You know what I'm saying? And yep. so when Trump attacks NATO, the Germans understand immediately what it means.
Yeah.
And then they have to come to terms with a reality where the U.S. is no longer supporting 100% the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And that's what they're trying to adjust to. Or to the reality that the Germans, I'm using as an instance, right. they cannot have it both ways. They cannot both be economic friendly to Russia through the pipelines for gas, natural gas, and so on, and at the same time claim to be on the side of U.S., former U.S. policy in NATO. You can't have it both ways. I think the German people, the Germans, who are not were not brought up on this idea of war in the post-war period. In fact, they were re-educated against it. I think the German people and German politicians will choose friendly economic relations with Russia and China over having, and I put quotes, a strong NATO. This is a new reality. They frankly, you know, Merkel has a friend or a fellow traveler in Trump. The German
That's
people
right.
who don't want war in Europe have a friend in Trump. And I think Trump's rhetoric, and I'll end on this, Trump's rhetoric about you need to up your contributions to NATO and your military budgets to 2% of your GDP, or he even went further and said 4%. I right. think he was saying, in effect, look, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization is unaffordable for Europeans and it's unaffordable for the United States. So let's begin the process of dismantling it.
I mean, in support of what you just said, again, Trump's own words, and you made reference to it, at the same time that he was there on a NATO trip, he yes. was saying to the Germans, you know, you got to buy more fracked, expensive gas and oil from us mm-hmm. and less from Russia, which is conveniently delivered through pipelines and, mm-hmm. you know, easy to extract and much cheaper. In other words, yes. you have to sacrifice your economy, not just by writing a check for 2 or 4% or whatever, but by making your decisions about your economic necessities on what's good for us and not what's good for your economic sense, which is That's also right. a harder sell. And he said it out loud. It's one thing if you're saying that in the back room. Mm-hmm. You know, if he had a 2-hour conversation with Merkel and only a translator, you know, the press wouldn't be worried about that at all. Yeah. Trump should worry about it because, you know, Merkel may come out of the meeting and say, oh, he hit on me or whatever. And who knows yeah. what the media would do then. But the reality is that if he went into a meeting like that and made these kinds of demands on Germany, and then you saw this kind of process play out afterwards, and somebody dared to mention that essentially Trump bullied Merkel in a meeting, the media, they could care less. But this is the reality of the relationship with the U.S. with all of these players, Japan, Korea. You know, when we talk about Korea, we're talking about the U.S. ultimately pulling out of Korea and mm-hmm. allowing Korea to be itself, which hasn't been allowed to do that since the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, if you spread that across the world, you are talking about a reconfiguration of the entire geopolitical scene.
And, that's right.
And that is being done not in pursuit of a policy of hegemony, which has been U.S. policy mm-hmm. pretty much since 1790, and instead of abandoning that in favor of an acknowledgement of the fact that the world is multipolar and mm-hmm. that there are natural conditions that militate towards this configuration of political forces here and there, like you know, the proximate location of oil reserves and markets, you know, from Russia to Central Europe, or, you know, the relationship of goods and materials that are in Northern Korea that might go into a factory in Southern Korea, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And if you strip off the expense of this massive military machine whose purpose is to enforce hegemony, and then if you take a look at the configuration of forces among the bourgeoisie and how it's so heavily weighted towards finance and away from production in the West, and you reconfigure those things, there are a lot of people who are powerful economically now that could do much better. And politically, you can enhance the condition of billions of people to in a way that you build a political constituency that could postpone the end of capitalism, or maybe the end of civilization, you know, for a century or two. And so there's got to be some people that are looking at it like that. Yeah, okay, Trump, when he says Workers' Party, he's not a socialist, and they are not looking to share power with the working class. What they're looking to do is change things so they can afford to buy them off like they did in the 50s or whatever. You know, if you could do what was done to the American working class, removing the racist component, and, you know, let people buy houses in the suburbs and all the things that were funded in the post-war period for, you know, the half of humanity that still needs these things, you're going to find an awful lot of support for whatever order is delivering that.
Well, let me say this. This is very interesting. You know, I see Trump not as the new Hitler or new Mussolini or the new neo-fascist.
Right.
In most, if you look at the political configuration of his ideas, he is very similar to the German Christian Democratic Party.
Mm.
You know, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, up to the 80s. That's number one. The other thing is, Trump's policies represent imperial retreat.
Yes.
If you don't understand that, that's ABCs of political analysis at this time.
Right.
The third thing, and I want to go back to this, we live in the United States under the most brutal form of the dictatorship of finance capital.
Yep.
That is why it is a mistake of unbelievable dimensions, proportions, to call Trump a fascist. He is not. Fascism, if you want to use that language, and I don't know that it is even appropriate to this moment.
Right.
But authoritarian or dictatorial rule of all facets of the economy, culture, the society, and on and on and on, politics is pretty much in the hands of a tiny group of people who control the financial system and hence the entire economy.
Yep.
We are under the most brutal form of the dictatorship of finance capital. And without understanding the class dictatorship, I mean, no one who claims to be radical has a right to talk about individual fascists. No, this is not an individual matter.
Right.
This is a matter of the class dictatorship.
That's right.
The fourth point I would like to make. This is a transitional moment in human history.
Mm-hmm.
The Chinese understand it. Xi Jinping understands it clearly. And in a lot of ways, when the 19th Congress of the Communist Party of China declared the thought of Xi Jinping or the policies of Xi Jinping on par with Mao and Deng Xiaoping, what they are saying in effect is that the thought of the party at this moment sees the future, the moment and the future, as a moment and a period of historic transition not just from one hegemon or unipolar world to a multipolar world, and not just from an Atlanticist focus center of global power to the Pacific, but what they are also talking about is the transition from capitalism and imperialism to socialism. It will not be the same in all countries. It will not be the same in all continents. Everybody will not come along at the same pace. But what the thought of Xi Jinping says, that the period of Deng Xiaoping, which was a kind of what you might call, what the Bolsheviks called the new economic policy, recovering from war and the destruction of revolution and counter-revolution, that period has effectively ended. And they see their society as now moving rapidly to socialism. Now, I would suggest a kind of socialism where the state and the market operate at the same time. Now, how they manage that is their problem. We can't tell them how to do that. But what we are looking at, and I think what the most astute thinkers, and I find them most concentrated in the Financial Times, they're probably other places, but I don't read enough languages. What the astute commentators are saying, be they in socialist aspiring China or Russia rebuilding from the devastation of the collapse of the Soviet Union, North and South Korea, and especially North Korea's idea of unification and socialism, what they're all saying, and even in the Financial Times again, is that this is a transitional period. The world will never be the same again. Right. All of the howling on CNN and in the in the New York Times and Washington Post, notwithstanding, these are people blinded by their privilege, by their class interest. The world is now in a transition away from what has dominated the world since World War II, certainly since Reagan made the statement to Gorbachev, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall," meaning give the West the right to determine the history and future of your country. That is all done. It's finished. We're in a new moment in history. Trump, who was claimed to be a dunce and an idiot, he perhaps is one of the most astute actors on the political stage in the United States. He realizes that without imperial retreat, the United States will have but one option, because the people will demand it. It will be capitalism or socialism. The people with pitchforks in hand, or the modern day equivalent of it, will march on the government, will take it down state by state, city by city, unless the people have the opportunity to economically recover from what was not supposed to ever happen again. Right. Another 1930s type depression, 2008, 2009, and continuing up to this point.
Yeah, you've seen exactly that unfolding over the last three or four decades in the United States and Western Europe and in Japan and in South Korea with on different curves because of the levels of development and the shifting of manufacturing and such. But the same dynamic affecting with ending up with a shrinking middle class. Right. An impoverished working class, and the growth of both of those conditions on the horizon for as far as you can see.
If I could just put a little drama on that idea of a shrinking middle class, you could also this is the process that Marxists and Leninists and radicals spoke about in the start of the 20th century. The pushing of the middle class into the working class.
That's right.
Ruining the petty bourgeoisie. pushing them towards homelessness and poverty.
That's
not
right.
just towards the stable working class, but towards poverty.
That's right.
This is a huge issue. When you get PhDs living in their cars, living off of food stamps,
well,
people highly educated.
When you take a taxi cab from the hotel to the Republican National Convention, and you start talking about politics with the cab driver, and you ask him, you know, well, gee, you seem to know a lot about this. Well, yeah, I have a PhD in political science and a PhD in history. It's like your cab. He's got three PhDs.
Right.
And this is the best job that they can find. I want us to go to this because we're getting close to out of time. And this kind of frames the whole thing. We had, you know, Trump going to NATO and to the UK and to meet with Merkel and all these other things. And then he comes back and there's all hell breaks loose back here. And quietly in the background in Johannesburg, the BRICS meet, okay? Mm. They had their 10th summit. And they issued a document, and the next BRICS is going to meeting next year is going to take place in Brazil. But this takes place in South Africa, and there's a whole side conference involving most of the African states where they're working out ways of relating to BRICS, sitting with Xi Jinping talking about the future relations between Africa and China. And here's the topics of discussion: strengthening multilateralism, reforming global governance, and addressing common challenges. That was the first listed captioned item on the statement. The next one, strengthening and consolidating BRICS cooperation in international peace and security.
Mm.
And then the closing one is BRICS partnership for global economic recovery, reform of financial and economic global governance institutions, and the fourth industrial revolution. This is, and they're doing that with the BRICS at the center of a meeting of the nations of Africa. Next year, the show goes to South America.
This is very profound.
Yep.
Especially when you consider that there is now an alternative to the IMF and World Bank, and it's called the Asian Infrastructure Bank and the BRICS Bank. So the financing of industrialization and infrastructure development on the African continent means that African nations and regions will not have to go hat in hand to the West.
Yep. And, you know, as we've discussed before, and this is something that we've seen going on in Latin America since Chavez was elected in 1998, certainly, there is a dynamic of the various countries, regardless of the political orientation of the various regimes there, moving towards regional mutual defense of their own sovereignty. And you're seeing all sorts of, you know, across the aisle kinds of alliances and agreements being made. And look, for example, China and the Philippines, you know, and look, for example, now, despite the fact that you had the coup in Brazil, Ted Temer, who has 2% and is, you know, part of the U.S. establishment of generals that ran Brazil for all those years, the actual economic benefits to Brazil of the BRICS itself and of being a central player outweigh the benefits of being a, you know, sort of a Trojan horse inside it for the U.S. Rather, they were there in the lead saying, let's build this institution into a global powerhouse and make the world itself that kind of powerhouse. Temer was saying things that Lula could have written for him, and it's out of necessity because that's what the moment demands. Well, we're out of time, Tony, so we'll pick this up next week.
Man.
Thank you, too. And, you know, you pointed out for better than 2 years now that this moment is a pretty important one in history, and we mentioned perhaps epical on a couple of occasions. I got to agree with you. So,
and I'd like to thank you because, you know, the ideas that I have and so on, I've had the opportunity to work them out with you publicly, and I appreciate this very, very much.
Me too. I appreciate it also, and thank you very much, Tony. We'll speak with you again next week.
Take care.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.